I'll open the Senate Committee on Rules for February 3rd, 2009. I will open public hearings on SB 30, SB 31, and SB 32. Could the committee administrator just give a brief explanation?
Yes, Senate Bill 30 relates to statements of economic interest that certain public officials are required to file annually. In Senate Bill 30, it removes the requirement that official list the name of each member of their household and each relative of the person who are over 18 years of age. Senate Bill 31 also relates to the annual statement of economic interest filed by public officials. And Senate 31 clarifies that when listing sources of income, the officials do not have to list sources of income that are less than $1,000. Senate Bill 32 relates to quarterly statements, a new provision enacted last session that public officials have to file quarterly statements in addition to the annual statement. And what Senate Bill 32 will do will make it so that those statements are only required if there is something new to report.
Okay. Thank you. The process today is we're going to go through some invited testimony. If there is time, we will take other people coming forward. I do have a person who's representing COSA and OSBA who's come from a considerable distance, so I will make sure to include that person today. We will obviously have several hearings, and just to indicate for the record again, these three bills are meant to be basically three of the core concepts that came first. They are not necessarily to be all-inclusive of all changes that we will be potentially considering, and they are actually the contents of the three could all be included in one. They're all within the same relating clause, and that's in the end what may happen. Mr. Burson, why don't you come forward? Mr. Burson, as many of you know, is the executive director of the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. When the legislature passed SB 10, they required him to come back to the legislature and report. In your package, you may have all received a copy in your office, but you also have another copy here on your desk of his report, and he's going to go through a brief overview of that. So, Mr. Burson, if you would just identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and I apologize today. I'm not feeling well, so I'm going to sound bad, and I'm hopefully be able to get through this report fine. But anyway, as Chair Devlin said, I'd like to go through this this report with you folks briefly. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer those. Chair Devlin had indicated that ORS 244290 had required that the Ethics Commission come before the Legislative Assembly in each odd-numbered year to talk about the challenges they have faced with some of the changes that have been made to the ethics laws in the prior biennium. And I've tried to outline those challenges that we have experienced with the changes, not only with Senate Bill 10, but also with House Bill 2595. Under Senate Bill 10 did several different things. It reduced the gift limit from $100 down to $50. At the same time, it eliminated the gift exceptions that were previously there and replaced those with a much more narrow set of gift exceptions. That included eliminating the gift exception for the consumption of food and beverage in the presence of. So not only was it a reduction in the amount of dollars that you could receive as a gift, but it also, that $50 included any food and beverage that you might, that a public official might have received. So as you can see, it significantly reduced the gift limitations. It also provided a funding mechanism for the Ethics Commission, and it also increased the frequency of information included in reports of public officials. Now, House Bill 2595 did many things also. A lot of those were internal to the agency. They included such things as establishing time frames for the agency to respond to requests for advice, increasing the time frames for the completion of preliminary reviews and investigations, the inclusion of relatives and members of household on the annual statement of economic interest, the elimination of certain I'm sorry, the elimination of the exception of 99 cities and 6 counties that previous to 2007 were not required to file a statement of economic interest. It increased the civil penalties up to $5,000 from $1,000. It also established the agency the ability to use a letter of reprimand or letter of education when in lieu of a civil penalty. It put some nepotism changes into the law, and it also brought the lobbyist and the clients that the lobbyist worked for in line in reporting. Prior to 2007, lobbyists would report 3 times in years where there were legislative session and 2 times in years where there were not. The entities that hired them would file annual reports. It's made it very difficult for the agency to actually try to compare those reports. Under the current statute, both entities and lobbyists report quarterly. So anyway, I'll talk about the challenges the agency faced. First, the largest challenge that we faced was training. A lot of changes happened on July 1st of 2007, and the agency was given the task of getting that information out to approximately 200,000 public officials. As you can tell, this is a very large task. Now, at the same time, the legislature had granted us another position as a trainer. That training position, however, was not funded until October of 2007. The agency was also required to move its offices. The offices that they were in previously would not fit any additional people, and so we also had to move, physically move the agency, and that happened on September 1st. The agency conducted over 30 trainings during the period of July 1st to January 1st. We also tried to work with many of the associations, the League of Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, to try to get the word out on the changes that were coming about. We also issued a lot of staff advice. This was a third level advice that the statutes allowed the agency to put out there. Now, the agency was able to bring on a trainer, and since that time, we have done a lot, significantly increased the amount of training that we've had out there. But the problem was trying to get all these changes out to all these jurisdictions across the state. It just created a large problem for us. And as you can tell, there was the next problem we go to is a statement of economic interest. Since there wasn't enough training that went out there to tell people the statement of economic interest was going to come about in April of 2008, I think that there was a bit of a surprise by folks out there. And I think that the ethics reform team had reported on that earlier, that the surprise helped or at least added to some of the turmoil that came about from the statements of economic interest. The statements themselves became a challenge for the agency. Not only did we increase the number of statements that the agency receives from approximately 4,200 to just a little over 5,500 by including these 99 cities and 6 counties, but we also required quarterly reporting by public officials that are required to file statements of economic interest. So therefore, the agency went from approximately 4,200 reports that are received annually to upwards of 30,000 reports received annually. This was a major challenge for the agency, and the agency had a difficult time processing the additional amount of reports that came into the office. Now, we've all heard the uproar, I guess, over the listing of relatives and members of household. The agency received a lot of that comments, and we tried to work with local people on that, but as I think it's been testified several times, is there was approximately about 200 plus people that had resigned their positions as in opposition of filing these reports. The other large challenge that we have seen from this filing or listing of the relatives and members of household is that judges from several counties in the state of Oregon had actually filed a general order with our agency requiring us or preventing us or prohibiting us, I guess, from giving out their relatives and members of household. This has caused a bit of a problem because we actually have a statute that says that we're required to give that information out, but in the face of a general order, so we have had to work with the Department of Justice and these judges, and we're continuing to try to sort that that out right now, but this has been a major financial burden to the agency to try to resolve this problem. The next level next challenge I'd like to talk about is staff advice. I talked a little earlier about that the agency actually has three levels of advice that it gives out. There's a formal advisory opinion, which is actually approved by the commission, and it offers the public officials safe harbor if they operate underneath that advisory opinion. There's a formal staff opinion that comes out that is actually written and signed off by myself that does not give the person safe harbor like an advisory opinion does, but it is a formal written opinion on a subject. And then the third level is this level of staff advice that was brought on by the changes in 2007. This is a less formal level of advice. It also does not hold safe harbor, but the agency is required to, We have to understand that we gave the advice if we were ever going to look at some kind of penalty for that. And we have come out and said that we would not penalize folks for operating under the advice that we have given, and we would simply give them the correct advice after that. But it's this third level advice.
Can we clarify that?
I'm sorry?
When they've asked for an opinion and you've given an opinion and you will not penalize them for that, your opinions are public. If another public official reads that and believes that their case fits that fact situation, do they have the same protections?
Chair Devlin, staff advice is more of a one-on-one conversation with the person asking for the advice. We keep those records at the office, but we do not publish all of that staff advice out there.
But your formal opinion.
A formal staff opinion, yes. Those are all published as an advisory opinion, and yes, we would give that same protection to any public official out there. Now, we have gotten staff advice for large numbers of public officials, so therefore we're not just giving it to one person. We may be giving it to several people at the same time. What I was trying to say is that if we are wrong in the advice that we give, we will correct the advice, but we will not penalize a public official for operating underneath the advice that we've given. The statute requires us to take into consideration that we gave the advice, but I've tried to take it a step further than that and say that we're simply not going to find a violation in that instance.
Senator Farioli, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I can wait until after Mr. Burson's testified. I have a number of issues.
What I want to talk about with the staff advice is to date, the agency has actually issued over 600 staff advices, and this is actually equates to about 1.5 FTE for a 7 FTE agency. So this is a significant portion of the work that's done by the agency is answering these questions that people pose to us. We understand that those questions, it's important to get these questions and answered and get them answered quickly because people have something that they are faced with they need an answer to, but I just wanted to point out that this is a major workload issue for the agency. The next challenge for us was the lobby reporting. I know we talk a lot about some of the problems that happen, but we actually, as an agency, have found this to be very helpful for us by aligning the clients and the lobbyists reporting at the same time. We have actually been able to audit some of these reports that the statutes require us to audit. In other words, we have received reports in our office that a client has paid for lobbying, but we don't have a registration from the lobbyist on there. Whereas before, when the clients were filing one time a year and the lobbyists were filing multiple times a year, it was very difficult to align those two reports. And so I would actually like to say that this has been a success for the agency in being able to make sure that those reports align with one another. It really has given us a chance to look at them and see if they are correct. The timeframes included in House Bill 2595 for the agency advice for formal advisory opinions and staff opinions have been a challenge for the agency. The commission itself meets about every 6 weeks, and we are required to complete an advisory opinion within 60 days. And so basically we're kind of given one shot at coming into the commission with the advisory opinion that we have. If the commission wants us to rewrite that advisory opinion, they don't agree with it, then we basically have kind of one more shot to get that right. If it's still not correct after that second time, or the commission can't agree to it, then we're not able to issue that formal advisory opinion. The 60 days time period with one extension has been difficult, as has the staff advice, which is 30 days with one 30-day extension. Again, it comes back to workload issues. With the amount of staff advice we're given, we're just having a difficult time getting that done. The other thing we faced this last year with these time frames is that we were asked a question that included 39 different questions in that at one time. And so we really don't have the resources to do 39 advisory opinions within that 60-day time period. So what we actually did was we issued 3 advisory opinions that included all 39 questions in there, and then we tried to give the recipient of that advisory opinion some type of guideline where here we are answering question number 26, here we're answering question number 22, and trying to be able to do it that way, because we just aren't able to do 39 in that amount of time. The electronic reporting system has also posed a challenge for the agency. This is a large IT project for a small agency to take on, but it's one that we're very excited about. There has been some talk, and one of the complaints that the ethics reform team had heard was that people are very concerned about their information being on the web and being able to be accessed anonymously by folks. But I would like to testify here today, and then if we could look at this in actually kind of two phases. The first phase is just the electronic reporting, how the agency takes in the information from statements of economic interest and quarterly reports. If we can, and of course this is also lobbyists and the entities are also part of this electronic reporting system. Currently, I talked about 30,000 paper reports are coming into our office, and we are expending resource in not only opening that mail, but sorting that mail and filing that mail away. The electronic reporting system is set up that these people will file electronically. The system itself will gather the information, it will organize the information, it will file the information for that. Instead of our resource being used for basically moving paperwork through a system, we can actually be using our resource for auditing these reports for accuracy, which the statutes require. So we're very excited about the electronic reporting system. Now, as far as public access to those reports, we've got to remember that the statement of economic interest, the purpose of that statement is not for the use of the state, it's for the use of the local jurisdictions to make sure that the people in those jurisdictions, what they are doing, kind of, it shows the local people where their interests lie and if there are any conflicts of interest out there. So it's important that people have access to that, but we can devise ways in this electronic reporting system that they can have access, but that access does not have to be anonymous. In other words, it could require a public records request. We just simply respond electronically instead of by paper. So I would really encourage the members of this committee to look at that reporting system as not only being a large time saver for the agency, but it also will benefit not only the people that have to file the reports, but the people that want to view those reports also. The last section I'd just like to talk about briefly is the investigations. The agency continues to see an increase in the number of complaints filed. In 2005, we received 73 complaints. In 2008, that number had risen to 138. This represents an 89% increase in the number of complaints received. We can have all kinds of discussions on why that is. I'm assuming it's a combination of a lot of things that are happening, but again, I'm talking about challenges the agency has seen and workload issues that that we have faced. And that is all I have, sir.
Okay. Senator Farioli, I think, was first.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Person, thanks for that update. That's valuable information. But I'll just remind the chair, who also served in rules in the last cycle, a lot of this stuff was predicted at the time. You know, we, as we were listening to the changes in Senate Bill 10, we basically told the committee, who had, you know, more authority certainly than the director did, because we were framing the law, that we thought that that it was an inadequate amount of time for training and information, and that we ought to delay the implementation for at least a year, because the sweeping nature of the changes were going to create this informational disconnect, and that's exactly what happened. We also had a discussion about the changes in the SEI, including all those folks that were exempted from 1974, that was going to cause a shear factor, that people would resign en masse, and they did. You know, that was, it may have been the perfect storm, but there was a clear weather report. There were storm warnings posted. We knew that was going to happen. And the quarterly filing became an issue because you're not getting four times the information. You're getting the information four times. You know, there isn't that great a change in people's top five income streams over a course of a year. And then I appreciate the fact that you're working out issues, Mr. Burson, with the judges that entered the general orders, but suing them and working them out are two different things. Because, you know, I don't know whether you had a choice in initiating the legislation or the litigation, because you're under order to disclose, and they have a concern about personal safety of elected public officials. I would hope that could be reconciled in this building, not in the courthouse. But maybe that's a challenge for the committee. One of the things I still think is very troubling is that there's no safe harbor. You know, if you seek an opinion and get an opinion, it doesn't mean that somebody isn't going to complain about that later and force an issue. And notwithstanding the goodwill of the director and the folks over at Ethics, there may be no choice, and I find it very difficult to live with that you could get an opinion from staff and have a complaint filed based on that opinion and find that there is no safe harbor at all. You know, there's goodwill, and there's an intention, you know, not to make it an issue, but as in other previous examples, you often don't have a choice about what you're going to do once it enters an arena where you're compelled legally to do something. So the goodwill notwithstanding, I don't think you can prevent something from becoming a much bigger issue just because you issued an opinion on it that offers no safe harbor. So, you know, all those things, I think, Mr. Chairman, offer a great opportunity for this committee to undertake some serious efforts to solve some of those problems. You know, we're well down the road now. I don't think that, we've taken our lumps on the implementation, and so people are getting much more familiar with the system. But I think now the issue on us is to do the things that we can do on the SEI to alleviate the major concern about having to file information about relations, relatives, and householders. And I'm glad to see that there's a bill to do that. And then the frequency of filing, I think, is something that we also ought to take up. I would hope that we would give the agency the authority to issue binding advisories that do offer a safe harbor, so that if somebody gets an opinion and relies on it, that the state's as good as its word, and that we regard that as binding. And then finally, I would love to hear a discussion, perhaps not today, given Mr. Burson's physical condition and in his statement that he was surmising that the increase was from a variety of causes. I'd like to know why there's an 89% increase in complaints. I'd like to know how they categorize. You know, whether or not we've just fueled gotcha politics or whether we've in fact done something to improve the transparency and the accessibility to issues surrounding ethics. But if these things break into a series of categories, I think maybe we have to analyze whether those categories are driven by the law or actually driven by ethical concerns. And in some cases, I think they're just technical issues that we might be able to fix. So all that's a very elaborate I told you so, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Before Mr. Burson replies, I actually agree with a number of the comments that Senator Ferriol has made. Only one to correct one. I was not on the committee at any time during its consideration of SB 10.
Memory's the first thing to come.
No, I did not come to the committee until after the session was over.
Okay.
Mr. Burson, did you care to respond to any of those comments?
Chair Devlin, sir, for that. The one thing I would like to talk about, and I didn't talk about here, is the changes that are made. We're here to talk about 30, 31, and 32. Is the only thing that my comment is that, especially on 30, is that the reports are due by April 15th. The agency itself is working right now to ensure those reports are out timely so people will have a longer period to respond to those. And so what I'm saying is we don't have till April 15th. We're going to make some changes. The agency will need to send out reports by March 15th.
Yeah.
And so that's my one comment on Senate Bill 30.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Burson. Sorry, not feeling well. A good senator here is not feeling well. We're all kind of in that first month of session where we're all worried like tomorrow it's going to be us, you know, it's going back to school.
Sorry.
And
daycare, so.
Yeah, kind of like that. I had a question. In your written testimony, that you since just July of 07, about a year and a half, you've had to issue 600 written advisory opinions, which is a heck of a lot, 600 documents of advice, according to your testimony. I was wondering if you could just, and I know you're not going to have an exact number, but can you give me some sense of the scope of the oral inquiries and comments that when people simply call your office and say, you know, what about this or what about that? I mean, we have the written documentation, but how much time is being spent with just people calling up and saying, I'm worried about this or wondering about this, and can you give me some guidance?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, we have actually tried to encourage people to get a written document from us because most of the time people are calling us and asking us some type of question, and it usually revolves around some type of event or, can they receive something? I mean, it's usually something that's happening pretty quickly. And the reason I talked about 600 pieces of written advice is we try to respond to them in writing. And so I don't know if I don't have this separate category for oral discussions. I mean, we obviously have oral discussions with people on some of just the kind of ideals, but if there's a specific answer that people need, we give it out to them in writing. And the reason that we do that is so that they can come back later on if there is a complaint, like Senator Ferrioli had mentioned earlier, that they have that written document from the agency that said that we had agreed that they could do that. So we've tried to make a commitment to give people something in writing. Now, there are times we ask them to give it to us in writing also because, as you know, when you have some type of oral communication, there could be things lost in the translation. So we'll encourage them to email us the actual details of the event or whatever the question is, and then we will give a response back. And so that's why there's so many more written things because I feel, though, it's important that we give that written answer back.
Okay. If I could continue, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just give you your thoughts, because you're the one on the front lines, and I know you get a lot of comments and frustration, heat from this, and the reality is we threw that upon you, so you're trying to do your best to do what we did, and I certainly understand and respect that. But as I look over the large amount of advice at staff time that you, as you have articulated, you have to do. Usually when you, in any endeavor, if you have these many inquiries of something and having to respond, you know, it's an indication things aren't very clear, which is why we have, you know, some pieces of legislation for us today that we're not, and rather than making things simpler or more understandable, it's been less understandable, less simple. And I was curious as to your interpretation of this. One thing I've talked about with the chair and others, and we'll be talking about during the course of this session, is that rather than try and parse out each part of law that we have created problems for, because inevitably in trying to rewrite it, we'll probably make it even more complicated. It just seems to be the nature of the beast. That if we could look at the overall issue of the public good, what are we really trying to achieve, the public good, and then apply an umbrella that covers all those things rather than necessarily trying to change relatives or SCI income level, but really look at the core issue, which is legislative and administrative interest. And if we can possibly define that clearer so that you can look and apply that standard so that, for example, a listing of a relative, you know, that I have a second cousin twice removed from Houston, you know, is mentally incapacitated, doesn't even know where Salem is, there should be no reason I should have to mention that. However, if I have, you know, a brother or a half-brother in Denver and they're on the board of the Energy Trust of Oregon and are spending $100 million in public, probably they should be on because they have a direct interest that's been clearly defined. Same thing with income. You know, if I have an ice cream shop or my wife has an ice cream shop in Cascade Locks, probably isn't anybody's business or has no impact on the legislature. But if that business is one that actively involves in grants from the legislature, or, you know, then that would make it a different qualifier. And I'm just wondering if you would give us some of your advice doing it on the ground, having to do this, is this, if we could create an umbrella that where you apply that standard to those all these different questions and filing, as opposed to trying to redefine each of the filing, that maybe our job might be a little easier, your job would be a little easier, and the public good would be better served because we would actually know people that are directly involved in the decision-making of that particular legislative body.
Chair Devlin, Senator Mesker, I think you hit it right on the nail right on the head. I mean, one of the first things that we ask ourselves and most advice that we give out is there a legislative or administrative interest? And that concept of legislative or administrative interest is a difficult one. It's a difficult one not only for us to interpret, but I think it's difficult for the public to grasp also. And so, I think the agency would be happy to entertain any ways to clear that up. Because you're right. I mean, a lot of the advice is basically asking, do they have a legislative administrative interest in the group or the person that's offering them some type of benefit? Mm-hmm. And that's usually what it comes down to. Because as you know, if there's not a legislative administrative interest, then the limitations do not, there is no limitations. Mm-hmm. So we would welcome any kind of clarification in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Burson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. And thank you for coming, even though you don't feel well. I hate even getting out of bed when I have one of those viruses. I guess my first question is, does the Ethics Commission have any kind of a, do they ever have a retreat or, you know, with staff, to really look at the big picture of what they are about and what their mission is and how they should go about in a global sense to preserve the ethical integrity of our process?
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, in the past we have used some of our meeting dates to get together with the commissioners and discuss basically the future of the commission, what we see the commission, you know, 5 years, 10 years, and so forth, forward. We haven't had one for a little bit. We've had some turnover at the commission level, and I'm kind of waiting for that commission to fill back up before I start talking about, you know, what the future looks like, but I haven't included a couple of commissioners because we're actually down a little bit on commissioners right now. But we do try to get together on at least on an annual basis and talk about those type of issues, not only what's facing the agency, but what's facing public officials out there. And so, yes.
Mr. Chair, Paul, yes. have you done that since the Senate Bill 10 passed?
Chair Devlin, Senator Berg, we have got together. We've had many discussions about Senate Bill 10. Just recently, we have not got together about this legislative session. What I guess wanted to say is it's just because we don't really have a full staff of commissioners at this time.
Okay. And you know, your testimony is just full of references to how much work everyone is putting in. You know, the people who file the reports, the people who process the reports, the people who interpret the law, you know, 600 opinions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To your knowledge, since Senate Bill 10 went into effect and you've had all this activity, can you point to any outcomes that are different in the area of ethics? In other words, something that you were able to pursue to improve the ethical climate of Oregon that you have done under Senate Bill 10 that you could not have done under the previous law?
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, I would have to point towards that training, the training position. I mean, this agency prior to 2007 was really an enforcement agency. I mean, we really concentrated on investigations and civil penalties for public officials that broke the ethics laws. We were really trying to do a paradigm shift and shift more towards training. And the one thing that Senate Bill 10 gave us was that training position. And so having that person, I know I get several letters and comments from folks that have had the trainer come to their body and thanking us for trying to clarify some of these positions. So that's probably the biggest plus I've seen. I think we actually have made a difference out there with a lot of people. And because the more training you get, the more comfortable you're going to get with how you can operate as a public official. But, you know, we have just hit the tip of the iceberg. And I think in the testimony they put down is that the agency is really trying to put a lot more resource towards that end. Because if we can... Now, if we can clarify things for folks like Senator Metzger had talked about, I think that not only will the number of advices that may drop down, but also we may get less problems that come to the commission as far as violations go, because the majority of violations done by public officials are really inadvertent violations. I mean, they really didn't know that they weren't supposed to do this, or they relied on poor advice or something like that. Not advice from our agency, but poor advice from somebody else in their group. And so the more that we can train, I think the better off we'll be. But, it's not a quick fix. It's a long-range type of goal for the agency.
Well, to follow up on that point, Mr. Chair, the training, if you had been training under the old law, would that have had value?
Chair Devlin, Senator Burke, I think it would have had value. I mean, the difference between the old law and the new law is that the limitations have just been narrowed down. I mean, the basic concepts of ethics has really not changed. I mean, you need to declare your conflicts of interest. You're only allowed to accept up to a certain amount of gift from any source that's out there. The old law had a little broader look at what you could accept. The new law has a much narrower. But the majority of our complaints isn't around the gift provisions. I mean, the majority of violations isn't that people have accepted too much of a gift. The majority of our violations are around conflicts of interest. Senator Metzger had alluded to this a bit. I mean, we get complaints from communities where people in positions of power are making decisions that either benefit them or relatives of theirs. I mean, there's just numerous projects around the state, and so those things really haven't changed. Conflict of interest is still the same. That's the reason the SEIs are used by people out there in the state of Oregon, is they contact their agency because they want to find out where their mayor's interests lie or where their city council or planning commission members. And so to answer your question, I don't think training ever would have been a bad idea. I mean, we would have had to change some of the limitations, but the basic concept of what you can, you know, you can't benefit from your position as a public official. I mean, those are the two biggies. You can't benefit financially or avoid a financial detriment. The declaration of conflicts of interest and how to operate underneath a conflict of interest. And then we have the gift limitations. Now, the agency also oversees executive sessions and the lobbyist regulations. But, those big areas are still the same. It's just that the line or the bright line has been changed a bit.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chair, is there's been so much effort and so much work and so much money spent on this. And I'm just trying to get a sense of what has been the payoff for the public. What has happened, aside from the training, which is a worthy thing, but what are some outcomes that have actually happened under Senate Bill 10 that benefit the public that would not have happened under the old law?
Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, I don't know if I have that answer for you today. It's not something that I don't hear enough from the public. I hear from the public officials. And we actually put out a long-term training plan that we put out there, and a portion of that was to start having conversations with the public out there and what can the agency do for them to assure that their government is run at an ethical level.
Well, I'd really like to hear it, because I still remember when we were in Pendleton, Mr. Chair, and we had all this testimony from the public officials about what kind of a burden it was. And at the end of the hearing, I turned to the audience and said, is there anybody out there who has anything positive to say about anything in this bill? And not one person stood up. And this is supposed to be for the public. And I'm not seeing the results here. And that's no reflection on you. I think you guys have just done an incredible job of struggling through and trying to, give opinions and implement this as best you can. So this is no reflection on you. It's a possible reflection on what we did in the law.
Senator Devlin, Chair Devlin, Senator Burdick, I would like to say one thing about the public that we do see, and that is the complainants that come before us. And there has been a lot of positive comments by them on that the agency has corrected a wrong in their community. So that's one area of the public that I do see. But those are folks that have contacted the agency.
But is there anything different in the substance of their contact and the substance of your remedy that is different under Senate Bill 10? That's what I'm trying to get at. Is this a tool that has enabled you to better enforce ethical behavior?
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Thank you again for coming. I'm sick. I really am intrigued by the nature of the questions of all my colleagues. I think that Senator Burdick makes a tremendous point, and so does Senator Metzger. I have a request of the commission, just to make this personal to me or to members of the legislature. I think we've set up a system. And if you look at when the Ethics Commission came into effect and the whole movement that came into effect when Nixon changed politics in America forever, because the commission came shortly after that, and we went from this pendulum of in American society where politics and public service was good to swinging that pendulum to being all politicians are evil, hiding something and are in it for themselves. And I think that it's incumbent upon this legislature and this crop of public servants to change that. I mean, I think we all have a sense of honor that we want to restore. And I think my concern is that Senate Bill 10 took us further back to thinking that all politicians were evil, rotten, hiding something, et cetera, et cetera. Give you a case in point, and this is where I want some advice. Long before I was ever in politics, I had a handful of friends. We went to school together. our parents became, my parents became like their parents became my second parents, old friends. We stood in each other's weddings, you know, and now there's wives, and then there's kids, and then there's God kids and all that stuff. And I like to cook, something I don't talk about too much, but I really like to, I'm into food. Under the legislation, we actually tested this because one of those friends became, God forbid, an attorney. And instead of a business person, became an attorney. And throughout, they actually became my attorney, which made it even worse. I'm a client. And this particular attorney is part of a firm, and that particular firm, through it's a big firm, sometimes has a legislative interest. So we tested this. Can I go over to their house for a potluck? And the answer that came back was no, because it'd be currying favor with me, because I'm rotten. I'm a terrible human being. The presumption of guilt is upon me after Senate Bill 10. And the presumption of innocence on an attorney, God forbid, that they, through the preparation
that
of steak,
seems wrong.
The preparation of steak on the barbecue would be currying favor with me. So we said, well, what if Atkinson brings a salad? I mean, now we're under the $50 thing. It's just, it's gotten to the point of silliness. So I want to know if I have to keep buying dinner for my attorney, which I think is just criminal. The point is, I mean, it sounds like a silly example, but this was actually a conversation I had last night. At what point do we say, hey, wait a minute, there's a human element here, and these people are going to be friends, our kids are being raised together, you know, this kind of thing. I mean, we do stuff as lifelong friends would do. But under a strict interpretation of Senate Bill 10, the pendulum has swung so far that nobody wants to, and I realize that I'm kind of the drag on the party, but, you know, the Atkinson family can't do stuff with another family because the other family is employed by somebody who might have a legislative interest, and by God, steak is going to make me vote some way. I need some relief. I need some hope here that the silliness, the perception of silliness, and the presumption of guilt on members of the legislature that are honorable people, that we can tighten that up and fix that out of Senate Bill 10. Because right now it's absurd, and I don't think it serves the public interest to have this belief out there that we're all rotten. Help me.
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, I think it goes back to the discussion we had earlier with Senator Metzger is this trying to clear up this idea of legislative administrative interest. I mean, I know there's a lot of examples out there of things that aren't allowed anymore, and they may have been allowed in the past because food and beverage was allowed in the presence of the provider in an unlimited amount before Senate Bill 10 passed. But I just want to be really clear that Senate Bill 10 did not change the definition of legislative administrative interest. It did not change the definition of a public official. It did put food and beverage inside that $50 limit. So, there are several examples that I've heard over the last, you know, year and a half, similar to yours, where, you know, I've been friends for a long time. We've always done something together. Maybe we've always gone to the Civil War game together or something like that. And whoever's school it's at is buying the tickets. Or, you know, we've always done this. We've been friends forever. Why can't we continue to do that? And I know that the Senate Bill 10 kind of put an end to some of that kind of activity that's out there.
Let me interrupt. Senate Bill 10 didn't put an end to that type of activity. Senate Bill 10 made it ridiculous. I mean, you can come over to my house if you bring salad. I mean, and these aren't people who have a legislative interest. That's the gotcha. I'm not talking about relationship with somebody who happens to be a lobbyist. I'm talking about that chain that goes further away from someone who's in the building as a lobbyist, who might work for a firm. It's down to the chain of ridiculous. And the presumption of guilt is on the elected official. And I don't think it's the fear that people live in that is starting to harm relationships. And that's the people element that Senate Bill 10 didn't have in it. I'm not talking about lobbyists. I'm talking about people who, down that guilt chain, if you will, that are afraid to do things with other people because the presumption of guilt is on someone who's elected. Maybe it's a mayor. Maybe a mayor in a small town. I get this. I represent a rural area. Mayor in a small town knows everybody. That's why they're the mayor. You know, they've born and raised somewhere. They know everybody. And now they're afraid to go down to the coffee shop. And down at the coffee shop, people are afraid to talk to the mayor or afraid to buy the mayor or allowed to sit around with a bunch of friends and have breakfast in the morning, which is actually where politics actually does get done. And now it's like separate checks because, you know, nobody wants to be seen as doing the... I mean, it's kind of got to the... We've taken the civility, I think, of politics out and taken it to an absurd level over, you know, $3 Denny's steak and eggs. That's what I want clarified.
Okay.
That makes sense? Or am I... Does that not make
Chair
sense?
Chair Dillon Atkinson, yeah, it makes sense. I say we receive a lot of questions like this, and it's an area of frustration for the agency too to answer those questions. But we try to answer them as best we can. But I do understand your frustration, and we get it from the other side too. The people that are trying to provide that to not just legislative officials, but all public officials. They're trying to buy the mayor a cup of coffee, and the mayor's refusing it. So we get questions from those folks, and so we try to explain how the law works.
Mr. Burson,
yes, sir.
I probably need to move this on, actually. Thank you very much for the report, and do want to indicate, too, that in a sense, you're receiving some comments that are based on a statute that we passed. So some of the indications of the difficulty people are having with the law actually rests probably with this body, and you're basically trying to enforce the law that you're entrusted to enforce.
Last question for me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Which members of your staff are required to fill out the annual statement of economic interest or the quarterly reports?
Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli, myself, the Executive Director.
How about the members of the commission?
And the members of the commission.
Okay. Just curious, Mr. Chair, because I thought that would give the staff a lot of firsthand information and a lot of practice on some of the questions that they would encounter if all the members of the staff had to fill out all the forms that are required of any of the public officials.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Burson.
Thank you.
Given the hour and given the fact that the brief overview of this report has taken almost an hour and we only have about 17 minutes left, Mr. Snyder and Mr. Winkles, you are both in the building on normal occasions, so I'm probably going to call you back on Thursday. We have Mr. Thielman, who has come all the way from Yonkala. And if you would come forward, and if you would spend just about 3 to 5 minutes, and then there's about 10 minutes of information that we need to provide to the committee for Thursday's hearing. So, and we will have an open public hearing on Thursday. So, I will take the two invited testimony first, but the whole committee meeting will be.
Well, I appreciate you guys letting me speak, and granted, this was short notice for me. We were at the conference, Funding Coalition Conference this weekend, and I hooked up with some lobbyists. Didn't buy them anything. They didn't buy me anything. But I said that I would be happy to come speak because my story is kind of unique. In Yonkala School District, we got caught in this.
You just need to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm Mark Thielman, Superintendent Yonkala School District. I took over a school district in which had... series of three board members who got crosswise with each other, all three of which received complaints from various relatives in the community, most of whom were not at any board meeting. And having had some experience being new to Oregon State and getting blindsided a little bit with some of these very loose and very strange rules, if you're from somewhere else, it's strange. It didn't occur to me that a state would allow its public officials and superintendents and teachers to be treated the way that they're allowed to be treated with the gotcha politics regarding complaints. So I appreciate very much you guys being willing to talk about that. I ended up in a labor conference, asked some questions of Mr. Burson, trying to help my board members in their defense. I just tied them up with attorneys, which they couldn't believe because all they did was declare a conflict and then vote, which they were told they could do by the superintendent. The other one had some other issues concerning his wife, who was the coach, whether or not to hire her or not. And he had, I don't want to get into the details, but when I came in as a fresh pair of eyes and really delved into everything, I didn't understand why they just didn't get some direction from the OGC saying, look, no contest. In the future, this is what you need to do. And that's it. But instead, they had to go through a series of phases, and that's why I gave it. I wanted to put something in writing, just in case my time was limited. Three things. My poor board members, when I explained to them that they needed attorneys, they said, but everything's supposed to be confidential. I said, well, if that were true, you wouldn't be in the paper. Because the OGC will say, yes, we received the complaint, and that's it. That's not confidentiality. Because next thing you know, the newspaper says, ethics complaint filed against this board member, that board member.
Don't mean to interrupt us, so the committee is aware the OGC has a bill that has been filed that deals with the issue of confidentiality. So please proceed.
Okay. I appreciate that. Again, I'm a layman. But the general gist holds true. I wanted to offer something that might help what Senator Atkin was talking about, clear up the silliness. Part of the thing is it comes down to controlling the complaints, especially if you see an 89% increase. To me, that's a shocking figure. My board members were very apologetic, and they're not trying to violate any laws or any boundaries. I wanted to propose that as a solution because my board members have suffered terribly, a lot of tears, a lot of hurt, a lot of strained relationships in their community. Senator Atkinson kind of alluded to some of that. One of them got recalled as a result of the coverage and the issue. And I remember one of them in particular called me, and she broke down. And I kept telling her, why are you so stressed about this? You haven't even been charged yet. She'd already been written up in the paper, and she's like, what? So I wanted to relay that. I'm here to say, here's the product of this process. The other one is when I began talking to the OG or the GSPC or whoever you call it, the investigator, I explained this stuff to her and I said, why can't you just give these people a warning? Because these are pretty minor violations and we're spending attorney time, superintendent time. I've had over 60 hours and I've been asked and subpoenaed. If I don't show up, they'll subpoena me for the defense of these folks. She said, we can't. The lowest we can go is a reprimand. I said, okay, we'll write a reprimand. Well, we can't because in order to do that, we have to either prove them guilty or they have to settle. So in order to settle, they have to say, yeah, I'm guilty. But again, a lot of these folks don't feel like they did anything wrong because they tried to do the right thing. And that's something I want to introduce, and that's that splitting hair issue. The third one would be to raise the minimum threshold from $50 to $250. There's other states that have raised their limit because the impact of this process is I had to tell my staff, you are to give me nothing for Christmas, not even cards. And I had to make that directive for my principals to protect them because we do live in a, you know, call it from time to time, can be a volatile community. So my two secretaries violated that directive and they bought me a coffee cart for $25 and they said, don't worry, Mark, it's okay because it's less than 50 and I had to explain that honoraria is 15. So I'll be reporting that. It absolutely puts a shiv in relationships, and it's not defensible. When I try to get direction from the agency, I get a series of changing opinions. And I don't know, when I call the OSBA or COSA and I say, look, everybody's telling me something different, can I eat at the PTO luncheon? And basically what I concluded is no. They said I could eat if I recorded what I ate, went to the person who prepared the meal, said how much did it cost, and I was directed to write all that down and keep it in a log. Now, how's that defensible? And what sense does that make? And I wanted this committee to hear that from me because I'm still spending time on this issue. Now, apparently I've gotten crosswise because I asked some questions I wrote the answers down. I called up attorneys and said, this is what the OGEC person said at the labor conference. And now I'm being told as of this Monday that that wasn't said. So I'm going, oh, brother, this is interesting. Two board members who were with me were the ones that were crossways with the one who's had the hearing. So I wonder if they're going to be subpoenaed to defend, and I'm in a small town. So I just like it to go away. Everybody gets it. They know what to do now. And that's what I'm saying is we need a process that allows people to be human, to even make mistakes, but lets the agency out of having to go through this big complex process for really minor or diminutive violations. I think that that would serve the public interest, especially guarding liberty in the concept that you're innocent until proven guilty, or at least in this case, innocent until formally charged, because people are incurring a tremendous amount of pain through the exposure they get just simply because a complaint was filed. It doesn't matter by who or what or when. Not a lot of hows. Anybody can file a complaint. And a lot of those complaints don't get tested until there's an investigative requirement. And unfortunately, the media picks some of these things up for people like board members. And this is what we get.
Okay. Thank you very much for appearing today. We are going to go through a series very quickly of amendments that you all received, I think, via email. I wanted to state that these amendments will be to SB 30. What is contained in 31 and 32 will ultimately become part of 30 also. At least that's the intent right now. These amendments are meant to be conceptual almost. It's not final language in the amendments. They're just general areas of discussion. There are issues that have come up reoccurring in hearings. They are issues that attempt to clarify some of the items in the statute. And one of them was just mentioned, administrative and legislative interest, is actually one of the amendments attempting to clarify and narrow that interest. And so the committee administrator is just going to go through them briefly. They'll all be out on the table for the public hearing on Thursday. It's not the intent that we're going to, I'd hope that we'd be able to move faster, but I think once all these amendments get out on the table, people are going to take a little bit of time to probably, the deeper that you get into this bill, the more confusing it becomes. So I think for a period of time, there'll be even more lack of clarity, but we'll come back together and actually be able to develop some degree of clarity within the next couple of weeks. So if you would start through the amendments, and I just wanted to comment on a couple of them.
And Mr. Chair, after the hearing, we do have some copies for folks today if they'd like. Yes, and my summary is intended to just be informational, and each of the amendments do make amendments. They're using Senate Bill 30 as the vehicle. They all keep the current language of 30 about eliminating relatives and members of household, and then they add new provisions. Amendment 30-1 does get to the issue of legislative or administrative interest. What it does is amend the gift limit laws so that they apply to sources reasonably known to have a legislative or administrative interest, and they leave it right there. It deletes reference to interest in any governmental agency, and that takes you back to the actual definition of legislative or administrative interest and clarifies that's only in the person in any matter that they have authority over. It makes the same change to reporting on statements of economic interest so that income over $1,000 is reportable from sources simply with a legislative or administrative interest, and again deletes the words in any governmental agency. Ledge Council added some conforming amendments to the rest of 30-1 to make sure that the ethics statutes are uniform and applying to both public officials and candidates for public office. Did you have a comment,
question,
Mr.
Chairman?
Yes.
I should have clarified that the heart of it begins on page 7,
yeah.
Section 3.
I thought, Senator Ferrioli, if you had a question, that's fine, but we'd just go through these today because we're going to have a lot of time to discuss.
This is a clarifying question.
Yeah.
This expands the reach of Senate Bill 10 by adding candidates.
That was a clarification that Legislative Council put in. That's probably an item for us to discuss.
Mr. Chairman,
because you actually have to file, you actually have to file an SCI if you're a candidate.
Right.
So they were trying, that was not a requested expansion, but that was one that Legislative Council felt that they needed to do for clarification.
I hope we will have a spirited discussion on the idea of expanding the net rather than contracting it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have additional comments
on
that?
No, go ahead. There are nine of these. So
yes, sorry.
And I see three are not here, so there's somebody else's.
30-2. This gets to the issue of exceptions from the gift definition. The current law allows an exception if a public official is appearing to speak as part of a scheduled program. And Senate Bill 30-2 will also allow this exception if the public official is representing a governmental body at that type of program.
The difference in that is that now, as you know, under the interpretation, you actually have to be on the agenda. So this would open it up if you were merely invited to represent.
So we don't have all these people parading up and say, please say something so you're legal, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Senate Bill 30-3, the essence there is on page 6. This does change the definition of public official. The current definition provides that public official applies to elected or appointed officials, employees, agents, or otherwise. This 30-3 deletes the two words or otherwise.
Yes.
Could you have a comment on that one?
The only basic premise of that is if you narrow administrative and legislative interest, we think we can eliminate the or otherwise, which no one seems to know what that means.
My question is, how did it ever get in there in the first place, and who's supposed
what
to interpret it?
Dash page,
but
it's not bolded.
Dash 3
is
page 6.
Line 12.
Oh, gotcha.
30-4. This is intended to be, I believe, just a matter of consistency. It adds the Director of Department of Corrections to the list of officials required to file the Statement of Economic Interest.
That's it.
Okay. 30-5 also amends the definition of gift. It gets to the issue of the personal friendships. And the way it does that is by providing that the term gift does not apply to gifts provided on the basis of a personal friendship unless the recipient has reason to believe the gift was provided because of the official's position.
What page is that on?
5.
That includes potlucks.
It probably would.
Potlucks?
Salads. It was on page 5, the new section O.
Bring your own salad.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I really appreciate the commentary by the gentleman from Yankala relative to the coffee cart. That's and also the commentary by Senator Atkinson, which dealt with somewhat the same sort of issue. But I guess I would suggest that if we're going to do an exemption based on something that's within the mind of the public official, it would be better for us just to do a flat repeal. Because all we're going to do then is say, well, we're friends, personal friend of mine. And
well,
and if that exemption becomes the umbrella exemption, I think we ought to just face our responsibility and do an outright repeal.
Okay.
Thank you.
The other aspect of this is that there are ways to deal with some issues that were brought up around the limit in terms of you can either do it by raising the limit or making exceptions. This is one of the exceptions. The other exception that was already mentioned was the exception that you are appearing in your official capacity,
right,
which would be basically the situation the superintendent would be in, basically is appearing in his official capacity, or basically the situation a county commissioner.
Yeah, or but when am I not in a small town in my capacity? Because I'm called
a superintendent. That's probably a more expanded issue. But
Mr. Chairman, if it wasn't for our status as elected public officials, there's arguably a case to be made that nobody would ever invite us to go anywhere with them.
All right.
Okay.
The last one, Senate Bill 30-9, that this amendment gets to the issue of gifts provided as part of an official's private business. And it does this by providing that the gift limits do not apply to gifts given as part of the usual or customary practice of the person's business or employment if they bear no relationship to the person's official position. And that's my summary of the detailed language.
Okay. Two examples of that have come to our attention, and there's probably more out there. A physician routinely receives samples of pharmaceuticals, which they normally distribute to patients. That's probably technically could be in violation of the current law. A teacher that is paid to work after normal school hours to coach a team, if they were also a public official in another regard, that might be actually technically. So what we're getting at is what would be normal in their normal outside their official capacity employment. So that if something is normal in their normal outside, that it's an exception to the gift statute. That's what it's.
So that coach could receive the team sweatshirt.
Yeah. And could be paid too, actually. That's it. There are still probably other amendments. There are multiple ways that each one of these amendments could be written, and I think that's one of the things that we'll probably ultimately discuss after Thursday. There are probably other amendments that people might want to put forward, but I thought we would spend at least a couple of meetings just getting fully deep into the bill and potential amendments, and then we'll probably take a slight break from this and then try to come back with something that I think hopefully will reflect the desires of the body as a whole to amend SB 10. However, I do not believe it will be a repeal. So we're here on Thursday. It'll be a public hearing. We've just listed SB 30, but obviously people can be commenting on any of the issues with SB 10 or actually the predecessor law. I will take the two parties from the counties and the cities first, but then we'll just open it up for public testimony. And with that,
Virginia, this actually
Jason. Good day.